Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. This season, I want to make sure that you know about the Southern Fork's Books from the Show tab. A lot of my guests are wonderful authors too, and so I created a Books from the Show tab on thesouthernfork.com so you can easily shop all of the guest books in one place. It links directly to Amazon, so you can use your Prime account. And to me, cookbooks and food books in general are one of the best gifts for birthdays, housewarmings, weddings, and of course, Mother's and Father's Day. It's an easy way to shop for those gifts and support this show as well, because a little bit of each purchase from this tab on thesouthernfork.com goes directly back into the production costs here. Check it out online, and if you're like me, you'll have a hard time not purchasing a couple for your bookshelf, too. Now, it's time to talk garden ingredients, classic fancy drinks, and bartending inspiration. I think Michael Lamon, bar manager at the James Beard Award-nominated Alley Light in Charlottesville, Virginia, wants us to slow down and take a beat. Probably over a lovely stirred cocktail in a fancy glass. On the day we recorded a few months ago, I was at high energy, just having started Charleston Wine and Food, and I went and collected Micah from the book signing tent to have a chat. Despite all the people buzzing about, literally and figuratively, and despite the fact that I chose a room with the Embassy Suites next to the hotel kitchen, AKA, you'll hear lots of ambient noise in this one, including a vacuum down the hallway. Micah was cool and calm like he just left a yoga retreat. We soon delved deep into a chat about cocktails and balance of flavors, and he proved that he really has a scholar's encyclopedic knowledge of the ingredients he uses and makes. That's fascinating, sure, and there's lots to learn from him here. But beyond that, probably the main lesson he can teach us is that following passion, in his case, the combination of ingredients and spirits, can create doors where there once were none. Charlottesville is not really seen as a cocktail culture stronghold, and yet the Alley Light has a fervent and loyal cult following. If you stir it, they will come, eh, Micah?
Welcome to the Southern Fork, Micah.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. We are sitting in a conference room, being really official today, Sitting in a conference room in Embassy Suites, which is really quiet compared to where you were just signing books in the tasting tents at Charleston Wine and Food Festival. You're here from?
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yes, and this is your first festival, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So what do you think so far? It's day one.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know how everyone isn't stuffed and drunk already.
They probably are.
Well,
the people that work the festival, we're not eating and having water. But I am so excited about your work. I don't really have that many mixologists or bartenders, so I want to start with that first. What is your title that you prefer? Some people are very particular about that.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, bartender, mixologist, either way, it's fine. I prefer not insisting on being called one thing or the other, just because I try not to be too elitist about what we do.
Right.
You live in a small town, and if, you know, people aren't necessarily into what we're doing, you know, the last thing we want to do is try to alienate them by being fussy about what we make them call us. So, yeah.
Good. Well, who is your crowd at the Alley Light? Who comes in, since it's a small town? Do you have some students, some couples?
We've got a lot of professionals. I feel like if people are just starting to get into cocktails, starting to get into, you know, or back into like vermouths and bittersweet cordials, things like that. So, you know, part of our clientele is well-traveled and educated and you know, seen fancy Amaro bars in, you know, New York, and then they are very surprised to see us doing fancy cocktails in Charlottesville, Virginia, which we are.
I love the unabashedness of being fancy. Your cocktails are just, they're balanced, they're complicated, there's a lot of home back bar ingredients that you make, house-made.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word fancy is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but kind of, if you look at old-timey cocktail books, they say, you know, receipts for fancy drinks.
Right.
So, I mean, it's like it's a historical thing. It's, you know, it's a measured cocktail, so that's, yeah. And then what was the other part of your question?
Oh,
what's our clientele? Yeah, we've also got some students and, you know, kids that are curious about, you know, cocktails. Most American kids, you know, it's kind of a curiosity, you know, what vermouth and
they'll try it.
Yeah.
Right.
What yop and holly is. Did I get that right?
Yop and holly. I think it's pronounced either way. Yop and yop and, yeah. I don't think many people are pronouncing it, so
okay.
We can kind of just go with that.
Great.
Well, what have you seen in the last year or so, before we get into specifically how you build cocktails and how you decide what to put on the menu, what have you seen people ask for, or what has been really surprising that you put something on the menu and people have been like, oh yeah, I know that, or what is that? Or
yeah, I think in the past couple of years, the amount of people asking for, like, bitter things has really gone up, which is kind of cool. Just because bittersweet cordials, they're such a mystifying class of ingredients because most people have never seen things like, you know, galangal or zetoware or angelica or cinchona or wormwood in their life. So it's very difficult for, you know, a consumer to, you know, look at what's in the glass and really attach that to anything that they've seen in the real world.
Or taste in the real world, I think. I was a kid of the 80s, and the kids that were behind me had all the sour stuff. Like, when I was a kid, sour wasn't a big flavor. But then the Sour Patch Kids came out. Do you remember that and stuff? And that was beyond me. So it took me a long time to build that sour palate. I mean, I like dill pickles, but as far as anything sour, like a goza or something like that, I couldn't.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. I was like, I don't get this. Like, what is going on? Why would you have sour candy? So I think a lot of people in the culinary world are really attracted to bitter. How do you use bitter in your cocktails?
Yeah, so kind of the historical way. So this whole trend of fancy drinks really comes out of the late 19th century. A bunch of cocktail books have been written about it. Dave Wondrick's kind of like the main guy. But the whole strategy that those guys employed was you have a theoretical base for your cocktail where you need a spirit base. You need to sweeten it, and then you need to balance that sweetened base with something assertively acidic or bitter, or in some cases both. So bitterness is really used to balance your other two necessary components of a cocktail. So it's kind of an indispensable part, especially of stirred cocktails, things like the Manhattan or Negroni.
And stirred are usually more boozy, right?
They can be, yeah. Mm-hmm. But they can also be, you know, lower alcohol, like aperitif kind of style. I've really been getting into sherry in the past year. You know, I thought sherry was stupid until, like, I tasted really tasty sherry, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, this is yummy. But, like, you know, sherry is a really great stirred cocktail ingredient because it goes really well with food, especially things like Oloroso or Manzanilla sherry. They're not too sweet, So, you know, they can complement food. They can also stimulate your appetite. So they're kind of perfect for, you know, pairing with stuff too.
Right. To have before dinner or right the first course or the appetizers. Yeah.
The Adonis cocktail and also the Dunhill.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Super perfect cocktails for food. So
tell us what's in those.
The Adonis is just like a 50-50 sweet vermouth Oloroso sherry cocktail with a little orange bitters, orange twist. So it would be really good with, like, you know, before dinner or like with some kind of like mushroom, whatever, risotto, balute, whatever fancy thing you want to pair with it. The Dunhill is really tasty. It's kind of like a Negroni riff. So it's like an equal parts build. You get some gin. You've got dry vermouth instead of sweet vermouth, and then Oloroso sherry instead of Campari.
That sounds really up my alley because I like gin.
Yeah.
So I'm always looking for different gin cocktails that aren't just lemony, citrus-based, or, just a spritz of some kind. I think a lot of people don't play with this.
Before you get hate mail about the inaccuracy of my Dunhill recipe, it still has a little dry curacao and absinthe.
Okay.
So a little lemon twist. So kind of it's really tasty with like kind of scallops or some kind of, you know, nutty, seafoody kind of, you know,
that
lobster.
Really
or,
good, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you get into this? Really, you went down the historical path, and then, okay, so you have a book called The Imbibe
that
came out this year, and it's really a 101 book.
Yeah.
It's not showing off what you can do. It's teaching beginning, you know, or people for the home bar some classic drinks. So you went from... You do classic drinks, but you do these really interesting new modern drinks and classics. And so how did you decide to do a 101 book?
I guess just real quick, I feel like I've really tried to anchor anything that's fancy in something that's very simple.
Nice.
So, I introduce a basic recipe and then I show you air quotes, fancy cocktail, and then show you how it's really just kind of a reworked version of the simpler thing, just with, you know.
So you're showing, like, behind the curtain a little bit of the Wizard of Oz thing, right?
It's not really all that complicated. And that has been the historical strategy for people, you know, in this golden age of American bartending. They're just kind of taking like ingredient, substituting, you know, a different but like ingredient. So, and then what was your original question there?
The original question is, there are a lot of bartenders that just do Scotch and Soda or Cosmos or Manhattans. How did you go into that historical rabbit hole?
I grew up not drinking alcohol, and my parents didn't drink. No one in my family drank. And, you know, I got a random job at a country club where, one night, me and all of my buddies, who were just kind of skillless busboys, got thrown behind a banquet bar, and they told us to bartend. And we were so baffled by not only, one, the culture of drinking, but also, you know, how unpalatable and disgusting we thought scotch and tequila and all these things were. So, you know, it's interesting. Some of my buddies who, like, worked at the... that, you know, country club banquet bar with me are still in the beverage business because, you know, they've been haunted by this question of, you know, how do you make this stuff taste good?
Why would you drink this?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think kind of that's kind of been part of a question that I've been trying to answer and then articulate for the better part of my life. Like, how do you make this taste just... you know, undeniably delicious.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully I did that a little bit with my book. You'll have to tell me.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful book. And it is, I love the simplicity of it. I like how it's easy to get into there. I do like the riffs on the classics and I love your writing style. So how do you build a cocktail menu, since you're so thoughtful, for your bar? How do you balance it? Do you have a number that you like to see? And
yeah, that's a good question. So the way we structure our bar menu, so, you know, you could do a couple approaches. You can have kind of like an encyclopedia list, which I think, especially in our market, is just kind of a little overwhelming for people, you know.
Because we can't, it's hard to say, what is that, Galanjo?
Yeah.
It's like, hard to say that word.
Right.
I don't want to order that.
I mean, if you show people, you know, a menu of 6 pages of things and with like clever drink names and then lists of ingredients that they don't know what any of those things are, it's just totally overwhelming. You know, a customer might take 20 minutes to order a drink. And,
right.
Yeah, that's just a...
That's not... that they're not comfortable if they're taking 20 minutes.
Right.
They're not comfortable.
So we pare our list down. So we have... we feature 4 or 5 classic cocktails, which mm-hmm. we change every season because we want to introduce people to kind of old-timey stuff that's super tasty and delicious. We keep a core set of 4 house cocktails that don't change, just so people could come in and still get, you know.
And they're your regulars. They
right.
want to know that
right.
some things are going to be the same.
And then we do a list of seasonal cocktails. And so, yeah, I try to, as much as I'm able, you know, introduce some kind of seasonal element.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for this past, this winter list, we did, I got a hold of a bunch of elderberries from
mm-hmm.
a farmer in Nelson County.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a stirred cocktail with elderberries and some whiskey and Fernet Coup de Mess. It's really tasty.
Elderberry is an extract, right? And it's you can see that.
Yes, it's a little berry.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this lady does this, but she harvests them all by hand.
Oh, man.
And so she brought me like 40 pounds of these berries that she harvested individually.
And how did she know that you could use 40 pounds of elderberry?
Yeah, so
you just kind of got this rep now.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, so this lady knocked on our back door right after we opened, and she brought us like 2 big bags of elder flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not the super fragrant European ones. They're an American variety.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, hey, you know, if you can use these, I'll sell you some next year. I was like, okay. And then knocked on our door 3 or 4 months later, brought some elderberries. I was like, hey, these are for you. If you can use them, call me next year. I wasn't really able to successfully use the elderflowers, but the berries made a really great cordial with them. And yeah, not to talk forever about elderberries, but it was really interesting. She was like, you know, this is how you have to handle them because they do contain, you know, a little bit of toxin that you can cook out. She's like, don't worry about it because I drink this stuff like every day. It's totally fine. Just make sure you cook the berries for 20 minutes. You're going to be good. So anyways, made this great cocktail.
Uh-huh.
Next year, I was like, I'll take 10 pounds of elderberries. And next year, I was like, I'll take the better part of your harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty cool to, you know, build a relationship with
right.
people in the community and, you know, have them bring weird stuff and then...
be able to use it.
Yeah.
And there's something fun and it keeps it, I can imagine it would keep it fresh for you because you're
yeah.
like, you're incorporating really a culinary approach to making cocktails, using a lot of seasonal ingredients that are indigenous or growing really well in the Charlottesville area, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's kind of part of the history of beverages. If you go, you know, travel in Europe, every region has, you know, their own, you know, bittersweet cordial that they make
right.
with, you know, the herbs from their area.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's really cool to be able to not only, you know, understand that history, but, you know, incorporate the herbs from your area into your gastronomy.
So you're a gardener too, right?
Yes.
You have, you purchase things from Monticello.
Yeah.
So how does that inform your work, your mixology?
Yeah. Have you ever been to Monticello?
No, I haven't, but I really, really want to go. I've watched films and read a lot about it, but
yeah,
I haven't been because it's not on a major highway.
Highway 64, maybe. So Monticello is really cool. Obviously because it's the, you know, residence of Thomas Jefferson, But it's also really cool because they have tried to, you know, recreate part of what his life looked like. Mm-hmm. He was an avid gardener. So they have this really, you know, elaborate garden. I guess it's on the southern slope of the estate. Mm-hmm. It's actually a microclimate where it's significantly warmer than it is above up where he lived. So they have like a gardener that grows plants and historically, you know, relevant plants to that time period. And then they also have a gift shop where you can buy seeds from the estate, and you can buy plants that are grown from estate seeds. So he grew a lot of plants that...
Yeah, he was an experimenter. He was the first guy with the tomatoes and all that, right?
Grew a lot of cocktail plants.
Yeah.
You know, he grew artichokes, he grew cardoon, he grew horehound, he grew, you know, lavender cotton, he grew wormwood, he grew lots of crazy, you know, medicinal in air quotes, culinary herbs that ended up in bittersweet cordials. So yeah, so I'm always on the hunt for these things because they're not things that you can buy at a grocery store. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can go to Monticello and buy a wormwood plant and then make vermouth with it.
I made my own absinthe once.
How did it turn out?
It was gross.
Yeah, it's tricky.
It's really hard. So I bought wormwood from Richter's, you know, that Canadian company.
Okay.
And they just have really good standards of... This was 20 years ago, and I grew wormwood for the season, and then I made absinthe, which is basically just Everclear with wormwood in it.
Oh, my God.
And
it was face-meltingly bitter, wasn't it?
It was face-meltingly bitter, and I served it at a Halloween party with sugar skulls, because I knew I had absinthe, and I knew, you know, about the dripping and the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I dripped it through the sugar skulls, and we still were, like, losing it. I'm glad no one died. I'm very thankful that no one died from that kind of bathtub approach to absinthe, but I learned a lot, which was there's a lot more in absinthe than just a neutral grain spirit and bitter stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's also interesting the threshold of bitterness that is pleasant is very delicate.
Ah.
And when you go too far, it feels like you're ingesting poison.
Yes. I feel like that was my finale of the party, and everyone left feeling like I had poisoned them, I believe.
Yeah.
And I could have, possibly.
Well, yeah, and just not to bore anyone with balancing bitter and sweet, this is a really fascinating kind of aspect of what I do. And I was working with a local guy, a friend of mine. He's a distiller. He has a distillery in Charlottesville. Vite Spirits make great rum. He and I were working on a prototype of kind of bittersweet cordial that incorporated some you know, foraged things and things from my garden, and it was really interesting. You know, we tasted, and there are so many variables to making a bittersweet cordial. You know, when you incorporate the herbs, do you macerate the herbs before you distill?
Right.
Do you put them in the neck of the still? Do you treat each herb individually? Do you macerate them at the end of the distillation? If so, for how long?
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to identify and taste things as much as we could, and it was fascinating. One, you know, how the threshold of things being unpleasantly bitter, we definitely learned about that. But then we also learned that, you know, when we added sugar to this seemingly unpalatable, disgusting poison water, it really balanced things out, and we were like, whoa.
Pretty quickly, because it can get too sweet too fast. I think a lot of, like, your the commercial Amaros that are coming on the market now with the Amaro thing, there's so much sugar and caramel coloring in them that it's almost fighting the bitter, you know, and I want that bitterness.
Right. But it's just a really interesting exploration into, you know, how it's definitely a dance between bittersweet, and if it's, you know, if it's seemingly too much bitter, it can be easily solved by adding, you know, just a little sugar. But then, you know, if you add too much, then it's just kind of cloying syrup.
Yeah.
So anyways, what we thought was going to be a total disaster ended up to be pretty tasty after the addition of, you know, a little Demerara simple syrup. Mm-hmm. So
nice.
Yeah.
Well, when you're tasting something in your garden and you know that it's edible and you're trying it out, and maybe you're growing it for the first time and you taste it, say an herb that you've never worked with before, do you have an idea once you taste it, like, oh, that might go with X?
Yeah, well, I mean,
is that how your mind works? I'm trying to get into, like, how your mind works.
Some of it's pretty mm-hmm. like reflexive and intuitive. So last year I grew some epizoote.
Oh, right. Explain what that is, though.
Yeah, allow me to be just a nerd a little bit more. So
that's why you're on the Southern Fork, Micah.
So epizoote is really cool. It's a Mexican herb, mm-hmm. and it kind of smells like a mix between, like kerosene and, like, lemon. And kind of, it's real green, herbally kind of taste.
But kerosene doesn't really sound like good eats.
Unless you paired it with a smoky, gasoline-y distillate like mezcal.
Uh-huh. Right.
So those things just seem kind of to be cognitively, you know, no-brainer. Mm-hmm. It's also really interesting because epizoote, the word epizoote comes from an indigenous language called Nahuatl. Mm-hmm. Nahuatl gives us all these great words that we have in the English language, like tomato, avocado, and chocolate. All come from Nahuatl words.
Mm.
And epizoote means, in Nahuatl, it's epizootl, and it means skunk sweat.
Oh.
And I think that skunk sweat is very much kind of evocative of the smell of epizoote.
Hmm.
Yeah. So.
Interesting. I've only ever seen it dried, though.
Yeah, it's really good with cucumber and mezcal, a little black pepper, a little saline, split-based mezcal tequila, mm-hmm. a little citrus.
Ice? No bubbles?
Oh, yeah, we're shaking it like proper cocktail.
Mm.
So,
nice. So, yeah,
it's really tasty.
Wow. So the next time you have a cocktail, please know that, dear gentle listeners, that there is a lot of thought many times behind that cocktail sip that you're about to take.
Yeah,
for sure. If people want to learn more about Micah and his work in Charlottesville, Virginia, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. I'm going to have links there so you can check it out. Also, there is a whole page. Y'all, I really wish you would shop more on this Books from the Show link on my page, thesouthernfork.com, because every time you shop there, I get like 0.001 cents, and so far I haven't made enough to get a check from Amazon. But Micah's book is going to be there, and it's going to send me over the top. I know it. The Imbible is what it is. It's University of Virginia Press,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you are looking for a great book to inspire your home cocktail bar, or to do a party where you maybe do two or three cocktails or try something, Micah's book is a great place to start. But also, if you like what you hear, I am so excited to bring stories to you, and it really helps if you subscribe or like them on your favorite podcast app. And if you feel so inclined, definitely leave a review, and if you feel even more so inclined, go visit Micah in Charlottesville. So, thanks so much. Let's get back to the festival.
Great. Let's do it.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?